and it was two Americans on a walking holiday. And it was clear from the moment we first stopped that they hadn't recognised the Queen, which is fine, she was used to that. The American gentleman was telling the Queen where he came from, and I could see it coming, and sure enough, he said to Her Majesty, "And where do you live?" She said, "Well, I live in London, but I've got a holiday home just over there, over the other side of those hills." And he said, "How often have you been coming up here, or for how long?" And she said, "I've been coming up here ever since I was a little girl, so over 80 years. And you could see the cogs turning. And he said, "Well, if you've been coming up here for 80 years, you must have met the Queen." And as quick as a flash, she said, "Well, I haven't, but Dick here meets her regularly." So the guy said to me, "You've met the Queen? What's she like?" And because I was with her a long time and I knew I could pull her leg, I said, "Oh, she can be very cantankerous sometimes, but she's got a lovely sense of humour." The next thing I knew, this guy comes around, puts his arm around my shoulder, and before I could see what was happening, he gets his camera, gives it to the Queen, and says, "Could you take a picture of the two of us?" Anyway, we swapped places, after we took that photo, we swapped places, and I took a picture of them with the Queen, and we never let on. And we waved goodbye, and Her Majesty said to me, "I'd love to be a fly on the wall when he shows those photographs to their friends in America, and hopefully someone tells him who I am."
A true story, and it circulated a fair bit around at the Queen's funeral. And I suppose Richard... what was his last name? Doesn't matter. He's the security guard up there, and he spent a lot of time with the Queen. I thought of that story, and I thought Nehemiah was a little bit like that in some ways too. Royalty is very different nowadays. In those days, it was kind of brutal, not as friendly and touchy and feely, and let's go shake hands with people. But he was with the king all the time, or quite often, and he would put his life on the line for the king as well. It's a high position of trust. I'll recap a little bit on where we've been. We'll go over some of the quickly over the history and the theology of Nehemiah before I move on. And you'll probably remember Ollie gave us a covering of the Old Testament, and I'm not going to go through the whole Old Testament, but basically we're at the very end, and Malachi is, you know, considered the last book in the Bible. Malachi could have been a contemporary, actually, with Nehemiah. So they're all around that 400, 450 mark BC. And then we have what we call in our Protestant Bibles a silent year, where we don't hear anything for 400 years until Christ is born. The Catholics have some other books, Tobit and Maccabees and Bell and the Dragon and a few others, and you can read them if you want. So it's almost at the time of Christ. So Israel, they were kind of under their height under David and Solomon, and then after that they had their bad kings, and finally it got worse and worse and worse, and God said, "Enough's enough, you've broken the covenant. I've been faithful all the time with my side of the covenant, and you have not. So I've threatened you, you're going into exile." And they went into exile, and it was in two parts, actually. The Assyrians took the northern kingdom in 722, and then 586, you had the Babylonians come and finish the job. And they took Jerusalem. And they were in exile for 70 years before they came back. And the new temple was actually, the second temple was built 516. So 586, 516 is your 70 years. And they call it the Day of Small Things because the first temple was incredible. Solomon just built this magnificent temple. The second temple, wasn't quite the same, but it was God's place to be worshipped in that temple. So that's about 516. Today, we're nearly 70 years on where Nehemiah is. Now, the exiles went back, but as you can see, not all of them went back. A lot were still in Babylon, and this is what you've got with Nehemiah. He was one of those Jews that was still back in Babylon. Theologically, okay, the exile trashed Israel in good ways, but they had a Zionist theology that Jerusalem would never fall, that the temple would never fall. So they knew that they'd get invaded and, you know, there'd be wars, but somehow they thought God would just never let that happen. And when they went into exile, that destroyed their theology. It was a huge thing for them. And where was God? Was God even with them anymore? And many cities around that time had these sort of things happen to them. The Greeks used to do it a fair bit. They'd go in and they'd kill all the men and sell all the women and children into slavery, and the city is gone, never to be heard of again. No family lines or anything. It should have happened the same with Israel. They should not have come back from this one. And it's the hand of the Lord that they did. It's just incredible. But their theology was different. It was shaped differently afterwards. they were very scared that this was going to happen again. And they learnt their lesson. They said, we did bad things. We admit it. And it was right that we went into exile. But this is never going to happen again. We will follow the letter of the law. So that's when the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, was written around that time. A book of, I think it's over 600 different little laws of, can you tie your donkey up on the Sabbath? Can you crush grain on the Sabbath? And can you do this? Can you do that? And they said, we're going to follow it to the letter of the law, so this will never ever occur again. And you get your Pharisees coming in. They're actually doing the wrong thing for all the right reasons. They had been stung. This was not going to happen again. So the theology is quite different. And you jump into first chapter of Nehemiah, classic post-exilic theology, where he hears about what's happened to Jerusalem, and most of the chapter is actually a big prayer. And you'll see that we sort of concentrate on the story, but most of that is a prayer. And in it he says, Lord, we went into exile, you were right, we were wrong, I sinned, my parents sinned, we all sinned, but you said you would bring us back and you'd gather us from the furthest ends of the earth and bring us back again. And that's classic post-exilic theology. And now we are going to follow the covenant. We're not going to break from the covenant. We've learned what was going to happen. So there's a bit of the theology. Timeline, I think we've had a timeline up there. The map, you probably saw it. Maybe if you flip back to the map again. Right over to the left there, you got Susa. That's the citadel. That's where Nehemiah was. Esther and Daniel were also there. And it's way, way, way over in Iran, West Iran, what we'd call today. There's a big desert, the Arabian Desert, so you can't just go cutting across if you want to get across to Jerusalem. You have to go right up there's the Tigris on the top. There's two rivers, the fertile rivers that you go along. There's Euphrates, and then you duck around the side. Takes about 4 months to walk along, and 1,500 kilometres, and there'll be bands of bandits and raiders and everybody on the way as well. It's not something you do lightly. It's a big journey. And that's what's happening. That was the capital of the time of the ruling empire of the time. So that's just a little bit of an idea. You've got Babylon is there as well. Not too far away. They sort of flip between capitals a little bit too. So there's a bit of a timeline, there's a bit of a history, and here we are. We've just come into chapter 2 of Nehemiah. When he got this word that it came from his brother in Jerusalem of what had happened, he said, hey, you know, the exiles have been back there 70 years, you rebuilt the temple, how's it all going? And he says, we're not good. We're really bad. The walls are broken down, and the walls are extremely important because a city was extremely vulnerable without walls. The gates were burned, and this just really impacted Nehemiah in incredible ways. And that's where he responds with his prayer. So that's where we're at. I'll get Alicia now to come and read the Bible passage. And we'll go into Nehemiah. If you've got Nehemiah chapter 2, 1 to 8.
Okay, Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 to 8. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, "If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy." And because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my requests.
As you're preparing for a sermon, you're thinking, what are you trying to tell me, Lord? Like, there's going to be people here. They're going to want to interact. Which way do you lead me? To be honest, quite often you just jump in and you hope it's going to be right. So we'll see how this goes. But I saw this as a murder mystery in a way. And if you're watching a murder mystery, there's always going to be, the detective will come out and say, there has to be a motive for doing it. Somebody's got to have a reason for doing what they do. They've got to have a means. So he's got to have a knife or a gun or something. He can't commit the crime without it. And there's got to be opportunity. Where were you on the night of da-da-da-da at this time? So you've got this means, motive, opportunity. And I see Nehemiah fits this pattern as well, a means, a motive, and an opportunity. I'm going to draw that out because I think ourselves too, it links a lot in with our own lives, and I'll get to that towards the end of it. You need a burden for a certain task, and you don't take these big steps without a very deep burden for something that the Lord's given you, a passion. I don't know if you've ever heard some news and spent the next couple of days fasting and praying and mourning and crying after you've heard some news and you're deeply impacted. This Nehemiah wasn't just, wow, that's interesting. It really deeply affected him, and I wondered why at first. I thought, yeah, okay, I read out the story, yeah, okay, he's deeply impacted. Then I thought, why? He knows that a lot of exiles are still back in around Susa, and not everybody went back. Why is he surprised to hear all these things? Why is he so upset? And I suppose the days before Facebook, as you know, it was a long trip to get back and forwards and to have news. He also believed the Lord and he knew his scriptures well. Lord, you said you're going to gather your people. You said you're going to bring them back. We've got the temple. What is going on? I think he actually felt shame on behalf of the Lord. And this is something in our culture, we don't feel shame, but honor shame cultures, to not have a city with a wall around it, you're looking pretty bad. And everybody's seeing the Lord's people and saying, see, they're nothing. They don't have all these basics that a strong society would have. I think it is shame on behalf of the Lord. I think there is respect for his elders. He said, the city where my ancestors buried looked like this. It's trashed. that shouldn't be like that. My ancestors should be honoured. Either way, he just knew it just wasn't right. This is just not going down this way. This is just not on. I don't know what to do about it, but it's wrong. It just can't stand like this. Have you ever felt like that when you've seen something or an injustice? You thought, this is just not right. This is not on. What do I do about it? I'm not the king. I can't change things. What am I going to do? And I think he just prayed honestly from his heart. He had this burden on his heart. So a motive. You need a motive at first to do something. Nehemiah had a motive. The Moravians, I don't know if you know much about the Moravians. They're an early Protestant movement, and they were fleeing persecution, and they went to Germany and had a settlement there called Herrnhut, which I'm sure I pronounced badly. The Lord's Watch is in English. What's significant about them is they were a strong missionary church. They're the first large-scale Protestant missionary group, and they were the pioneers of the modern missionary movement. Their all-consuming purpose was to spread the gospel to the ends of the earth. And I read lots of stories about them. They just took off everywhere, just as missionaries. Some of the very first Moravian missionaries went to the Caribbean island of St. Thomas. They went there in order to minister to the slaves of the island, even selling themselves as slaves in order to get access. Think about that on the job description. What would you ever do that to try and reach some people you don't even know in a foreign part of the world? Say, actually, I think I can get in. If I'm a slave, they'll send me over there and I'll be with these people. How's that for a motive, a drive, a zeal? Would you commit a nice crime so you could be locked up in prison and minister amongst prisoners? Would you do that? I'm not encouraging you to do it, but I'm trying to put the mindset there of what drove these people beyond anything else. It just had to be done. So there was a motive. Nehemiah had a motive. He was deeply impacted by what went on. Has the Lord given you a burden for something that deeply? Youth work, I know my mum and dad are here. Happy Mother's Day. And Dad's been doing CRE for 30 years in the schools. Some people are impacted by environmental issues, poverty issues, music ministry. We heard that this morning, a passion. And thanks for warming up the group for me, Sean. But that was a passion, real passion for music. Cross-cultural ministry. Some of us are just really just want to get on a plane and go. Elderly ministry, prison ministry, raising your children in a godly way, a burden for that. And I know there are families that is their burning desire. They want that. So pray for his leading in this area. And you might be sitting there thinking, oh, I don't really have a burning desire for anything. Pray, because the Lord has made you for a certain purpose. There's only one of you and one place he puts you. Just pray that he will give you a burning desire and a passion for how he's made you. So there has to be a means. So there's a motive for any good crime, a motive, a means, and then the opportunity. So what's the means? And Nehemiah, he had a very unique means. He had access to the king, and he knew that not many people had that access. It was quite a privilege to be able to do that. It seems like he had access to confront the queen as well. She was also there when he asked. Esther was similar, wasn't she? Esther had that unique access to the queen, and I'm going to read a little bit from her story in a moment. Just a unique aspect. And I know there's been things in my past life too where you sort of have to step up and do something, and if you don't do it, God's going to do it. He just won't use you. You won't have the privilege of being used by him. He'll still get his will done. He allows us to be part of the solution. The cupbearer, what is this job? And Milton told us it's a pretty cushy job, isn't it? You hang out with the queen and drink wine all day. And then he said, well, it's not quite like that, and he's right. Back in those days, you didn't know who your friends were, and a lot of kings were murdered. In fact, King Artaxerxes, that we're talking about today, his father, Xerxes, who Esther, Queen Esther, was the queen of Artaxerxes, he was murdered in his bedchamber. So his dad was murdered. He knows Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes knows all about it because his dad was murdered. And this is not just a once-off. This goes on and on and on. You'll jump back, I suppose, to Joseph, where you hear about other cupbearers. And there's a cupbearer there, and Joseph's in prison, and you got the cupbearer has a dream, the baker has a dream. The cupbearer, he's the first one to taste the wine. He chooses the wine, he tastes the wine. If it's poisoned, sorry, need another cupbearer. And so he was putting his life on the line. In many ways, he was that security for the king, for his food. And people were trying to kill them. So, yeah, something we don't really think about much today. What has God put in your hands that you can use? What are your means, I suppose? And you think, well, I'm not a cupbearer. I don't hang out in Parliament much. What do I have? A couple of years ago, I was put in the mines for a year. Didn't know there were any Christians in the mines. Gradually, I met one or two, and they weren't much of a witness, really. And I was just really impacted that you can't get into the mines unless you have done all the inductions and you're on the team and you're underground and you got a job. You just can't go there. I don't know of any pastors in the mines, haven't heard one. I don't think you could put a pastor in the mines. I'm not sure. But I was there in a place that nobody else could get to. Nowadays, I work at a different place. I don't actually know of any Christians where I work. I don't think you'd be allowed to walk into my workplace. You wouldn't. There's security and all the rest of it. You can't walk into my workplace unless you have a job like I've got. And I work with guys all day that I'll be the only Christian picture they read through the day. Where has God put you where you have the means to do something that probably nobody else can do? You might think, oh, I don't know too many people. You've probably got some friends and they're reading a picture of Christ every day with you. There's opportunities that come along. I know missionaries too quite often do actually talk to kings and rulers, and I've been in the governor's office a number of times discussing things, the governor of the province, and I'm thinking, hang on, they didn't teach me this at Bible college. It just happens. Be prepared. It might come along one day too where you think, I wasn't prepared for this, and I get this tap on the shoulder. Can you please advise me on this or that? It could be schools. It could be any place. Have a think about where the Lord has put you. What means has he given you for where you are? Things that you can use for him. Gifts, skills, whatever. Nehemiah, it was quite interesting too. Part of his means was his preparation too. He had prayer. And that was the first thing he went to. And you see, the book of Nehemiah, that first chapter, most of it is prayer. And then you see chapter 2, we get in there and we're into verse 3. Verse 4, the king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed and to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. Even then he's praying, and I think Sean was talking about that too, wasn't he? He says, oh, I don't tend to just sit and pray, but I pray throughout the day. I live life as a prayer. And this is the way we should be living life too. And do you do the same? Do you shoot up those little prayers when you're in the middle of the king has just asked him a question, he's about to answer, and even then there's time for a quick prayer. Do you pray like that throughout the day when you come across an issue or a problem? Or is prayer just a once a day thing of dedicated time? Nehemiah did both, and I can't overestimate how much prayer he put in. The month of Kislev, I think it said in chapter 1 at the start, the 20th year of King Xerxes' reign, that's November. That's when he heard what had happened in Jerusalem. Okay, when he goes to the king, it's now the month of Nisan, which is March, in the 20th year of King Xerxes' reign. There's 4 months there. What did he do for 4 months? Like, if he's so deeply impacted, why didn't he do something straight away? There's a number of reasons. I think prayer would have continued on. If he prayed and fasted and wept for 4 days or whatever it was, he would have kept on doing that. So I started wondering, well, why didn't you just go to the king? What's this 4 months about? Nothing in the Bible is a mistake. And there can be a few reasons. One is King Xerxes had a winter palace in Babylon. Maybe he ducked off to warmer weather for the winter and he wasn't around. It could be that. It could be that I actually think Nehemiah probably didn't know what to do. He says, this is not right. I don't know what to do, but I know it's not right. And it was probably 4 months of praying to find the direction and find the way forward is probably what it was. But yeah, there's various things. There could be other things too. If you're going to go and talk to the king and he comes grumping in and kicking the dog as he comes in, today's not the day. I think I'll leave this one. And he's just had the baker executed. Yeah, I'll think today's not the day either. I think so. He could be waiting his time. He could be waiting his own time. Today I'm just not feeling it. I don't think this is what I should do today. When we try and reach somebody, we've got to be very genuine too. That's where I sort of struggle a bit. I feel guilty sometimes that I don't talk to somebody about God. And then there's other days where it just happens naturally. You're sitting there and you think, this is the opening. I know it's mine. Do I take it? Do I not? And yes, you jump in and you share. And other days it's, I'm doing it out of guilt. This is not going to work. I just feel it's not right. Maybe that was happening a bit with Nehemiah too, just trying to pick his time. When is the right time to do it? Timing is everything with a lot of these things. So various reasons there. Why did he take so long? And I don't quite know. So he preparation. I was amazed too. Nehemiah really did his homework, didn't he? 4 months, I think you've got time to think. You've got time to pray, and the Lord had given him a plan. He says, right, I know what I'm going to do. You don't go to the king with some half-baked idea. You've got to have it worked out. So chapter 2, verse 4 to 8, the king said to me, what is it you want? And he knew already. Then I prayed and to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city. I've got to go. I can't send anybody else. You've got to send me. The king says, how long is it going to take? He gave him a time. Yep, I got the time. While I'm at it, I need a letter because all these territories I go through, they're going to want to kill me, so I need protection. And I'm going to need to, you know, a Bunnings voucher here to get this thing started as well. Like, I've got to have access to your forests and your building materials. Can you give me all that? And the king says, yep, yep, yep. And then the king at the end says, look, I'm going to throw in an armed escort as well. And that was of the king's initiation, because he knew you don't just walk through those places, you'll be killed. So the homework had been done. I was impacted too by the king. I can see you're upset. This can only be sadness of heart. That's a compassionate king. That's a bit more like our previous queen would have been. That is not a normal thing of the kings of the day to do that sort of a thing. So I think I have to take my hat off a bit to the king as well of what he did. Opportunity, means, motive, opportunity. Did he have the opportunity? And opportunity, I'm sort of calling faith, bravery. It's fantastic, eh? But yeah, did he have the bravery to do it? Often we have the opportunity. We have the means, we have the motive, we're at work, we're with these people nobody else can be with, we're Christians, we want to tell them about God, and it's, do I do it? Is today the day? Is today not the day? The opportunity comes along, do you take the opportunity, do you not take the opportunity? And we're scared. Don't think that Nehemiah wasn't scared. Where did it say in here? I was very scared. It actually said, I was very scared. So the king asked me, why does your face look sad? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. I was very much afraid. Don't think that he wasn't scared doing this. He knew what was on the line. So opportunity. Are we brave enough to do it? Timing, as I said, is everything. Waiting for the right moods and how the king was feeling. I'm going to get Jessica to come and talk to us a little bit. She's going to do a reading. part of it is to show you how brave Nehemiah was. I think he had a death wish, to be honest. He to do something like that was extremely brave. The story of Esther puts us in the picture a little bit. So Esther chapter 4, she's going to read a little bit. I better turn that on for you.
Okay. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. And that was Esther chapter 4, verse 4. And then from verse 9, what's the name?
Hathach.
Hathach, there we go. Went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death, unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. For 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Then verse 12. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.
I hope you're getting the picture. I wanted to read that to you because this is King Xerxes' father that has these rules. He will put to death anybody who comes to him unsummoned. You don't just go to the king. You don't go there if you're miserable or upset. Take your problems outside. The king doesn't want to hear it. If you make the king upset, he'll probably kill you. So you don't do this. What he's doing, he's breaking every law. But it gets worse. This guy really had a death wish. King Xerxes had already said to stop rebuilding the city. So now you're going up to the king and saying, I know all this, but you kind of got it wrong, mate. I've got a bit of advice for you, if you don't mind. And I've jumped well off my passage, but I'll try and read it to you. Yeah, Ezra chapter 4, 21 to 22. Now issue an order. This is King Xerxes saying about 15 years earlier. Now issue an order to these men to stop work so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter. Why let the threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests? So you knew the king's position on this topic already. You knew you don't go there upset or unannounced. And you do this. I think the words very afraid probably don't tell us just how scared this guy was. He probably thought, this is it, I'm not going to live today. That's bravery though, and that's conviction. He had that drive, he knew what he had to do, and like Esther, even if I get killed, I've got to do this. Things are just not right, you've put me in this position, Lord, nobody else can do it, I've just got to do it. So it's on a knife edge at the moment, and I kind of like it, because it's unfortunate when they say you'll hear about a movie review and they say, look, spoiler alert coming up, turn your radio off if you don't want to hear how it ends. And we've already heard how it ends, because I would be thinking this guy is going to be toast. And unfortunately, we already know the end of it, but it's a cliff edge and he doesn't know. That's the thing. We read in hindsight, if we've done something brave or somebody else has done something brave, we hold them up as heroes. We're really wise and smart in hindsight, aren't we? We're really brave in hindsight. If we all knew how the story was going to end, that's not bravery. You're just acting it out. You picture yourself in front of the king. You know this is the day. You're doing it. You're asking him. You're going in sad. You're doing everything wrong. What's going to happen? And that's the point of bravery. And I think that's where often we drop the ball. If we knew how the story ended, if we could jump half an hour into the future and say, oh, look, they're going to accept what I say, and that's not bravery anymore. So this point of faith is saying, Lord, I know you want me to do it. Your way or my way, which one's it going to be? Well off my notes, but I'm having fun. I hope you are. It's sort of hard. Like it's the Bible, it just weaves together. It's beautiful the way it comes together. Often we miss it though. We don't put our shoes in the same, our feet in the same shoes that the people of the time had. So we look back and we say, you know, wow, this is really good. Nehemiah is a great guy. He's a faithful guy. He had it all planned out. Yep, Nehemiah, thumbs up. And Nehemiah would say, you've totally missed the point of this story. No, that's not what it is. Verse 8, and because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my request. That's what he would say. He knew full well he shouldn't have lived through this attempt. So then do we say, oh, well, Nehemiah, thanks for turning up, but really we didn't need you? No, he came with he had a means to be there as well, and he was faithful with what he was called to do. So which is it? Is it God or is it Nehemiah? And the answer is it's both. It's hand in hand. And you'll find this in your own life. The Lord gives you abilities or places and things to do. The success comes from the Lord, though. I'll read you another bit from Zechariah. Zechariah is actually the guy who built the second temple. So he's about 70 years earlier from today's story. And the temple got stopped halfway through the work when they were trying to rebuild this second temple. There's always been opposition. And the Lord gives a word, not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. And that's how Zechariah rebuilt the second temple, by my spirit. So you have might, you have power, you do it all in your own abilities, but the spirit of the Lord enables it. That's a key that you've got to take away today. It's not just about you and how smart you are and how clever you are or whatever. The Lord's got to be in it. I think also motive is a big thing as well. Sometimes, and this is why sometimes you'll need 4 months of prayer to work out what you should be doing. How often have you been praying for something? You've prayed for months, maybe years, and then after a few years it's, actually I'm not going to pray that anymore. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what the Lord's leading me to do. And we can very easily get our motives mixed up with what God's leading is. So don't be quick to jump in unless you know it is of the Lord. Once it's of the Lord, and how do you know it's of the Lord? Yeah, one of the kids asked me that the other day, and I said, it's different every time. I can give you examples of what the Lord's done. For us to go to PNG, it was like two magnets just attracting. It was just crazy. We just had to go. I can't tell you why or anything. It was just a mad desire. I just had to do it. That was one. And I didn't have any guarantees, but I got to the point of saying, we've got to do this, even if it ends badly. I'll get to 60 and I'll regret that I didn't do this. I just have to do it. That's one calling. It took, well, we're going to go to Sydney for a year, weren't we? We were there 6 years and finally we went off. It took a long time. The calling took a long time. So yourselves as well, sometimes, typically it takes a long time. Sometimes it might be clear. An angel says, okay, do this. Okay, I don't have to think about that one. I just better make sure it's the right angel, but... So I don't want to put God into a box, because every time you say this is the way he operates, he'll do something wildly different just to show you how creative he is. Success came from the hand of the Lord. There's a proverb that sums this up quite well. Proverbs 21 verse 1. In the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels towards all who please him. That's exactly what happened. In the Lord's hand, the king's heart was channeled towards Nehemiah. Nehemiah pleased the Lord. And that's exactly what happened, is Proverbs 21:1. New Testament examples. Well, there's lots. Biblical examples everywhere. Gideon, David, Elijah, I could go on and on. They all had similar situations. Paul jumps at me though. I remember, you know, Acts 26, 1 to 2. Then Agrippa said to Paul, "You have permission to speak for yourself." So Paul motioned with his hand and began his defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defence against all the accusations of the Jews. He did get called before kings to give it a defence. Jesus gave us some ideas, because what if the king called me? What do I say? And I've had it a few times where I remember once I was asked a real tricky question in Papua New Guinea, and I'm thinking, man, I'm a missionary. I should have a really good comeback for this. I can't think of anything. And the Lord actually gave me some words that I look back on and think, whoa, I was out of my depth at the time. I'm so glad. Luke chapter 12, 11 and 12, Jesus said, when you are brought before synagogues, rulers and authorities, do not worry about and how you will defend yourselves or what you will say, for the Holy Spirit will teach you at the time what you should say. You won't know. The Lord will guide you. He'll put words in your mouth at the time when you need to. I think the ultimate act of bravery and obedience was Jesus praying in the garden before he was crucified. Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done. He knew he had to do something. He was in a unique position, and it wasn't what he wanted to do. He wanted to do his Father's will, though. Lord, I'm going to do it. Esther, if I perish, I perish. This is what I'm going to do. And Jesus is our ultimate model. He knew exactly what it was going to be. He already knew the end of the story. Esther didn't. Nehemiah didn't. Applications. Well, life is meant to have challenges. I know I'm going against culture here to tell you that. Life is meant to have struggles. It wasn't meant to be easy, so get over it. It's just not. And lumps come along, and some of them are very big lumps, and they're very hard to get over. We always love that story where the hero wins, and against all the odds, he comes out and beats everybody, and he shows great bravery and courage, and finally succeeds. But would we ever do that ourselves? We watch these movies. Would you ever do it yourself? We are a very risk-averse culture. Anything that can be insured is insured. I was thinking about Mawson, who led an expedition, a research expedition out in the Antarctic, and two out of his three companions were killed. He came back, they welcomed him as a hero, and he got a knighthood. Today he would be put in jail and ran through the OH&S issues of what he did wrong. And culture's just totally changed. I'm not saying go against the law and break the law. What I am saying is you are going to have to risk things sometimes. There will be things in your life you think, this could go badly for me. Lord, I've got to do it. I know you've put that passion on my heart to do it. There's a saying, I haven't heard it, I sort of made it up, but I like it. If there's nothing worth dying for, then there's nothing worth living for. I think this is driving a lot of extremists in the world today, young people who they just want a reason to exist, something to make their life significant. And the Lord gives you that when he gives you a calling on your heart. So once again I ask, has God ever put a burden on your heart for a particular task? And if he hasn't, pray it through. Don't get your desires mixed up with his desire either. And it might take months of prayer before he reveals to you what he's put on your heart. You're going to have to ask for bravery. You're going to be too scared. If you're not, then you don't really understand what's going on or how serious it is. You should be scared at these times, but that's where faith comes in. Is, Lord, are you going to take care of me or are you not? Bathe it in prayer and fasting. We don't pray fast very much, do we? But it comes out in the Bible all the time, fasting. There's often an important season of waiting and being quiet before the Lord. So bring your desires to before him and listen deeply to what he's trying to say. Sometimes we say, well, yeah, I've done that in my life. I've done some brave things and, you know, the Lord's going to be happy with me. But I heard an interview of a football player once, just after a game, big win. So, how do you feel? And he says, not even thinking about this game, it's history. The next one, next week, that's what I'm looking for now. Don't always hang on to what you've done in the past. It's gone. It's the next game that's important. So don't think you're off the hook just because you've done something for the Lord. He's going to ask you to do more. Those who are given a little, he'll give more. So we have a motive as Christians. Our heart is for the Lord. We want to see his kingdom come. We have a means. It'll be different for each of us. The skills he's given us, the places he's put us. Do we seize the opportunity? So means, motive, and opportunity. I want you to take that away with you. You'll have a means. Think about it. You'll have a motive. Think about it. The opportunity is what you need to embrace. Thanks for your time. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I did. You may not, but I loved it. It's a brilliant section of the Bible, and it'll be great to read on into the latter chapter two as well. I'll hand back to you, Ollie.
Thanks very much, Mike. I invite the band up, and we'll sing a closing song. As they're coming up,